History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And if we're willing to take a little time to ask a few questions of some of our more experienced neighbors and to listen patiently for what comes back our way, those stories don't have to go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service to our country. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that endeavor, we always come out ahead because not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It's not too often that something that was lost more than 75 years ago is reunited with its owner, but that's what happened when the cup from an ex-prisoner of war's mess kit made it back to him. When I heard about that, I had to get in touch with Harold Radish, who was gracious enough to spend this hour with us from his home in New York City. Before we talk about this latest twist in 2021, let's talk about your childhood in the Big Apple.
I'm an immigrant son. My parents came from Poland. They came a lot before the Second World War. They weren't involved in the prisons and stuff like that. They came because they were pretty poor. From what my mother used to tell me about when they were kids cleaning up for the kitchen, it was a sand floor. So, you know, it was Poland, and at that time it was a sort of a part of Russia. And the problem with the boys was that the Cossacks would come around and pull them, draft them into the army. So they would try to get to the States as quick as they could. They didn't know each other when they were growing up. They came here separately, and eventually they met here. How did they meet? On the Lower East Side in Manhattan, where all the Jews lived that came from Europe, there were movies. And it was a time where a movie was two people for 5 cents. So you had to find the one that had that odd penny. And my father apparently had an extra penny. So they got together, and from then on, eventually, you know, they got married.
So you're here because of a lucky penny? Is that what you're telling me?
That's what it is. That's what it is. And they moved from the East Side. My father was a plumber, but he had a problem. He could do jobs and stuff. He knew his business, but he didn't know the English language that well, so he couldn't pass any of the licensing exams. So that was a little hard for him, but he made a living. They moved to Brooklyn, Brownsville, which was a step up at the time for them. The family moved. It ended up with my mother and father, her mother and father, my father's mother and father, and an uncle. They bought a house, which was a six-family house, and they all chipped in so that they could have three apartments on one side of the house, and the other side was the rental, so that they could sort of carry the house while they worked. They were fairly poor, from what I can understand, from what I had heard. In those days, they worked in the Garment Center in Manhattan. That was the big thing in New York City. The Garment Center was pretty good for 6 months. You worked for 6 months, and then you had to scrounge or do whatever you could for the next 6 months. The women, before they gave birth, just, you know, up until the time they got married and a year or so after, would work as seamstress in the Garment Center also. That was the big industry. My dad, he was the plumber. And in those days, he didn't have a car. He carried all his tools and whatever fittings that he had in a bag on his shoulders. And if he had a big job or whatever it was, he would have to go to Manhattan. He would go on the subway or the elevated. And they took care of me. I grew up fairly well. I didn't know what poverty was or anything, but went to junior high school and high school, and I ended up taking industrial arts. I became a shop teacher. I went from high school to NYU, and I was lucky. I got a scholarship to NYU. I was at NYU, I guess, about 6 months when I got drafted.
And what about being in New York City in those years? And, you know, I've heard so many stories from baseball fans, whether it's the Yankees, the Dodgers, the Giants, all these teams that were in the Big Apple.
It was the Dodgers at Ebbets Field. We had the Knothole Club. That's what it was. I don't remember the guy's name, but somebody ran what they called a Knothole Club, and you ended up, if you went to a certain place at a certain time, you would get a ticket, and you would sit in the bleachers, and then you were part of the Knothole Club. That was the big thing, Ebbets Field. When the Dodgers went out to California, they built apartment houses on Ebbets Field, and that was the end. That from that point on, I didn't follow baseball.
Do you remember, as a boy, having some ideas of, hey, when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do with my life?
I had some idea. Most of what I got into was because of my parents, especially my father. In those days, they were insecure in their work. So the big thing was civil service. They told us constantly, you study, you work, you'll take an exam, you'll become a school teacher, you'll work for the city, you'll get paid, you'll get vacation, and you'll even get paid for your vacation. That was the big thing, because when they were off, they didn't get paid. I remember there was an uncle, he must have been about 40 years old. He became a civil servant. He was the first one in the family, and he worked for the Department of Sanitation, just shoveling the offal into a can. In those days, they were horses, and they made such a party for him, like he became president for the United States. This is the first guy in our family that got into civil service. He was recognized, you know, he was an American, so to speak.
You know, something else that I'm curious about, I don't know if this will trigger anything or not, but many of the Jewish American veterans I've talked to had a feeling about the war long before America was in the war, because they would read the newspapers and they'd hear things, and some even had family members who were still in Europe and were becoming either displaced or taken captive because of the Holocaust.
The ghettos and the Holocaust. You know, fortunately, I don't remember anybody in my family being in the Holocaust, involved in that. But we did see the movies and stuff, and we were very, very upset when there was Hitler and Mussolini, Il Duce, you know, and we'd see the movies, the Fox Movie Tone News, you know, battles and taking over of the Reichstag, the fire, you know, and things of that sort. That I remember. And you know, when I grew up in the family enclave, the six-family house, where everybody spoke Yiddish. I knew English from being out on the street, but my Yiddish was very good. And that got me into trouble in the prison camp. You know, I used to think that Yiddish was close to German, and it was. Occasionally, I would interpret for some of the guys with the guards. The guards in the prison camp wouldn't recognize that I was talking Yiddish or asking them questions in Yiddish, because they weren't that educated. They thought my German was from the country somewhere, you know. But we went from one prison camp to another prison camp. And before you went into that other prison camp, you were searched in a way. So what you did was they lined you up, and you, before you got in, you had a blanket. Everybody had a blanket, whether it had holes in it, you know, it's winter time, holes or torn, but you had a blanket. And you spread that blanket out, and whatever you had in your pockets, you put on top of the blanket. Whatever you didn't want them to see, you dug a little hole under the blanket, and you put it in there. We were sitting there, and it was, I don't know, it took quite a while. But then the guy in a white shirt, which apparently was an SS guy, came by. And foolishly, I said to him, "Wie lang? How long?" And he looked at me, and he, in German, he said, "Jude, you Jew, Wall Street, you started the war, verfluchter Mensch." I still don't know what that means, but I remember these words. And I must have gotten ashen. I was ready to pass out. He did have a little baton, and he wrapped me on a knuckle or something. But somebody called him, and luckily he walked away. And then the guys got around me and said, "What happened? What happened?" I said, "Forget about it." And that was it. Never said another word of Yiddish again.
Wow. Boy, that's alarming. I can't imagine how that must have felt.
Oh, boy, it took a while to get over it. You know, I'd been shot at. I had shrapnel drop on my head and all the rest of that. But that didn't scare me as much as when this guy started to yell about Wall Street and so. I thought I was finished at that point.
Well, I believe it. I'd like to hear a little bit, too, of what led up to that. And it seems like all the World War II veterans I've had the privilege of talking to remember something about December 7th, 1941. Do you remember hearing about the attack on Pearl Harbor and really America's entrance into the war?
Yeah, I was in high school at the time. And I do remember it was a Sunday. I think it was a football game or something. And then the Pearl Harbor came on. And where was Pearl Harbor? Who had any idea of what it was? You know, we had studied geography in elementary school and all. And then when we got to school that Monday, there was the speech that the president made. And this I remember, and I keep remembering this all the time. I remember lunchtime. I remember we all used to have these long, straight pretzels that we'd buy for a penny or 2 cents. And I remember the mustard jar in the middle of the table. You take a bite of the pretzel and dip it into the mustard jar and take another bite. But this was 10 other people were dipping into the same jar. That I remember. And I remember Pearl Harbor, but it didn't hit. You know what I mean? I was a youngster. It didn't mean it was like the news. You know, it happened, and that was. And I still remember the movie tone, da 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 da. You know, that kind of thing that we saw in the movies all the time. Those always there. Movies was a big thing with us. I think we always went once or twice a week to the movies.
Well, you know, that makes me wonder, too, as I talk about Pearl Harbor and folks who were there on Oahu had the fear that the Japanese are coming back. People on the West Coast here were afraid of the Japanese shelling the coast or bombing. And where you were on the East Coast in New York City, I've heard stories about, you know, the U-boat threat, that was a real palpable fear of U-boats off the coast. Did you ever catch wind of much of that?
Yes. Yeah, there was U-boats. One of them, I think, got to Staten Island. But I don't know. Maybe I wasn't that sharp at the time, but it didn't really hit. Yeah, it was news. I heard it, and that was it. It just, there was no real fear yet. I had no fear, you know. Even when I got into the service, there was no fear, you know. Maybe I have a certain intelligence up to a certain level.
Well, when did it become real for you? When did you realize, hey, I'm going to have to be a part of this nationwide effort?
Well, when I got overseas, it started after Metz. I was a replacement. I was part of the repo depot business, and I sailed over on the Queen Elizabeth. So there wasn't that problem with 10 days or 14 days. It was 6 days, and we were going pretty fast. And they got in with the 90th Division, the 357th Regiment. And I was a recon sergeant. I was trained in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. That's another lifetime. Going from New York to Hattiesburg, seeing this mass of all these people, and sometimes getting out into the town and seeing the signs, no color, you know, this. I didn't understand what was going on at the time. But while I was in training with the 69th Division, they started what they called cannon companies. They added a company to a division that would have the 105s. They started it, and then I took a test or something, and they made me a recon sergeant. So it was a good life in camp. I had a Jeep and all the rest of it. But when I got overseas, I was still a recon, but when I joined the company, you get into the company and everybody looks at you, you know, they don't trust you yet. They don't know who you are, what you are, and how you would work. But then when we started after Metz, we kept moving down France, got to Luxembourg, in that area, the forest, the Aachen forest. When the stuff started flying, then you knew you were a soldier. You would look across the line, and they would say fire, and you'd fire. I had to go out ahead of the group to get some information or whatever. You know, you were not frightened, but you did what you had to do. It hit me when the stuff started coming down. The Germans had shells that would hit the trees and then they would explode and throw a lot of stuff at you. That's when things got a little heavy. I remember leading a company from one area when we had crossed the Saw River into Sawlock and Sawbroughton, and I remember bringing them as a recon. I supposedly knew where we were going, and that was tough. We had to do that at night. There was firing and all the rest. The guys that I were bringing were a new company, and I had to tell them how to get down and, you know, break up and not be close together. The threat was when the stuff got hot, when stuff started flying all around you.
How close did it come to you?
Well, I'll tell you, I was in a foxhole with three guys. This was before Bastogne. We couldn't move. The Germans were going on the way to Bastogne. We were on a little hill. They must have been down in a little valley. I could hear noise of marching constantly, day and night. And we were in this foxhole. We couldn't move. You raised your head up. Something came flying. One day, some guy that was with me, we had a few logs on top of the foxhole. There were three of us in there, and it was big enough so that when some shell must have come by, a piece of the shell came through and hit him in the butt. Somehow it got through, and it was right next to me, and I said, "Ooh." But he started screaming, so we took a look. We cut off his pants and all, and it was just like a little scratch. And we said, "Look, if you ever get out of here, you got a $1 million wound. You'll be going home." So that's when it really got close. I was never really afraid. I don't know what it was. I was not comfortable, you know, so to speak. I can remember before we got into the prison camp, it was late at night. They wouldn't let us in because they couldn't check us. And this was February. I remember being on top of a bale of hay or something on the outside, freezing. That's the kind of thing that bothered me. I remember being in the cattle cars. You know, there must have been about, I don't know how many, at least 50 or 60 guys in there, squished together. And I remember being, in a way, not frightened, but trying to figure out what was going on. And then when our air corps came by and strafed us, then you got frightened again. You know, it was fear that came up when these instances started. Although they pulled the trains in under tunnels, so we were all right.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 96-year-old ex-prisoner of war Harold Radish. We haven't heard about the circumstances of his capture yet. And there's a little twist to his story that did not arrive until more than 75 years after his liberation. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 96-year-old Harold Radish of Queens, New York, Douglaston to be exact. He served with the 90th Infantry Division before, during, and after the infamous Battle of the Bulge.
My outfit came to Bastogne, to the Bulge, just about near the end. So it wasn't that bad, but it was cold, but not that cold. We ended up in a warehouse of some kind. In that warehouse, surprisingly, there was a concrete floor, and I remember foxholes that had been blown out somehow in that concrete floor. I do remember it being cold, but not that cold. I remember looking out and seeing Germans coming at us in their white uniforms and people firing at them and them going back, you know. The coldest I was in the prison camp. That was rough. Outside the camp, as I said on that February, that night was terrible. Then we got inside and we were in bunk beds. The bunk beds had slats of wood. And there was a little belly stove in this barrack. And this buddy and I, luckily I teamed up with a guy that was a bright guy. He was a staff sergeant. And he was bright and honest. And we worked together. J.J. McEntee, I remember him like, you know, it was yesterday. But I slept on the top. He slept in the middle. As it got colder, we would take the slats and put it in the stove. By the end, before we had a move, we were both sleeping on the floor, on the bottom. That was cold.
And I want to hear more about the prison camp. I'm sure I'm not the only one who'd be interested in the circumstances of your capture as well, because I'm sure you never expected or planned on becoming a prisoner. What was that when you had that realization?
This was after the bulge. We were going through Luxembourg, etc., and we went to the Siegfried Line. The Germans called it the Wall. This was the border between France and Germany. And I think we were a stab kind of thing. What we did was my company would work at night. At about 2 o'clock in the morning, we'd go in and sneak around a pillbox. We'd get around the pillbox, get to the door, and put a C2 or a charge right on the door and blow it in, and then we go right in and take it over so that the next day we could fire. There was usually a gun on top of the pillbox so that we can cover as the outfit behind us came in and started taking other pillboxes and moving in. The night that we started, we went in, we set up machine guns outside this big box, and we fired away. Apparently, the Germans weren't there. We got into this box, then they came, and they started firing at us, and there was a steel door, I remember, slamming that shut, and we were in a big bedroom. This was a gigantic concrete bedroom. There was one, two, or three rooms. One room had 25 Germans in it. We had captured 25. They were in bed, and that was it. But we couldn't get out, and that was it. We were there, I guess 3 or 4 days, and we had run out of water, and there was no food. The K rations, whatever rations we had, were used up. There must have been about 15 of us and a first lieutenant. I can remember drinking some of the water that was, you know, on the ground, etc., and that was it. And then one morning, we heard a voice say, "Do you have any prisoners there?" with a heavy German accent. "Do you have any wounded?" That's what it was. Somehow the lieutenant said yes. And they made some agreement that for about a half hour or so, they would let him out to take a look around, and they would send in somebody to pick up the wounded. We had some German wounded in there, too. When the lieutenant came back, he said, "Fellows, it's all over. There's none of our troops around. We are thoroughly surrounded." And that was it. At that point, I was frightened. I was so frightened, I got rid of my dog tags, because on the dog tags was stamped H. I wasn't a hero, but I was going to save my life. And other people threw their dog tags away, too. There were some of the Catholic kids that threw their dog tags away because they felt that their religion wasn't recognized by the Germans. When they took us down into a little town and there were the German soldiers, they were frontline guys, and we were talking. We started to barter again. I had a little pack of juice, powder. German says, "How many cigarettes?" Oh, talk about cigarettes. You could board all of Europe with cigarettes. That was the money. That was it. And from then, I wasn't frightened at that point because there was a different attitude. The further back you got behind the German lines, the tougher they got. Those are the things that, you know, you're beginning to bring up memories.
Well, and I think most people are following along, but when you say you took off your dog tags because they had an H stamped on them, the H is for Hebrew, it would reveal your Jewish faith and perhaps make you a bigger target for your captors?
Yes, that's the way I felt. I felt it was a little not heroic, but I said, look, I got to save my life. That's it.
How much did it help or how much did it change things to be with those other guys that you'd been on these patrols with that you knew a little bit, that you guys had each other in that situation?
The sergeant that I was with, I was a sergeant, he was a sergeant. We were close. We took care of each other. The other guys, I knew them, but not as close. I remember being interrogated when we came in. There was a German officer, and I sat down. He says, what is your, and his English was perfect. Your name, and you know, your rank, and your number, and what did you do? Where, what was your service? Well, I said, look, I can't tell you what I did. The regulation is I should give you my name, rank, and service number. And he said, okay. And he turns around and pulls down a window shade behind him. And on that shade was a whole lineup of the division and my regiment down to the companies of the latest second lieutenant that got killed.
Wow.
It was amazing. The information that they had was amazing. Then, to top it off, he says to me, Radish, Radish. Oh, and that's when my mind was going around. You know, I thought at that point I was going to get it. He says, Radish, Radish, what kind of name is that? And all of a sudden I said to him, it's like British, you know, like pepper. And he laughed. He said, okay. Then the son of a gun pulled a deal on me. He says, do you have cigarettes? I said, yes, I have a few. He says, if you give me one cigarette, I can give you two of mine. I want to taste American cigarettes. I said, all right. I gave him three of mine, and he gave me six or seven, and that was it. And then he gave me a loaf of bread, a loaf of white bread,
wow,
which was fantastic because most of the time they gave us black bread. And that was to show that when you went out and you went in with the guys that you said, you know, you must have said something to get a white bread. But everybody that was interrogated got a white bread. A bread. We'd get bread every morning. A hunk, a large piece of black bread. It must have been, oh, I would say, 8 inches long by about 3 inches wide. That was for 12 guys. And we used to have cards or whatever. And the guy with the high card would get the knife. Somehow we had a knife to slice it into 12 even slices. The reason he would do it, he would be able to take a slice and the crumbs. But as he sliced, we had our eyes on him. It had to be exact. Otherwise, we'd scream. And this happened every morning.
And I don't know if this would have been exactly the same bread, but I've had a few ex-POWs tell me that that black bread was mostly sawdust and not very easy to cut.
You're right. There's mostly sawdust, and there was hay in there or whatever it was. And then we got a big, they came by with a barrel of what they called soup, but I think it was just black water, whatever. And you always had a cup, and they gave you, you took, you know, somebody. And, you know, our group was non-coms. And as non-coms, the Germans wouldn't let us go out to work, so that we had to hang around in their barracks. And at the end of the day, at about 5 o'clock, we had what you called a Wall Street. You had guys that went out to work. And when they came back, they had to go through a little alley near a fence. And we would stand, I guess, about 5 or 6 feet away. And they would walk by. And while they were working on the farms or wherever it was, they would steal a fruit. They would bring either find an apple or a potato or something. And they'd hold it up. And you held up one finger, meaning a cigarette. And if the guy okayed, you threw the cigarette to him and he threw the apple to you. And somehow, these were not American soldiers that were coming by that had been working. I don't know where the other guys, you know, those that weren't non-coms, where they had sent them. It must have been to another area in that camp. But when they came by, if we had gotten a Red Cross package that had cigarettes in it, the price of the apple or the potato went up. It wasn't one, it was two. Somehow they knew. It was amazing. You know, the things that went on in the camp, we sort of regulated ourselves. Every morning there was a PEL. We would line up, and we had a master sergeant who was in charge, would line us up. We'd have a ceremony. We'd mention the names of those that had passed away. We had mentioned the names of those that had gotten sick and any news that there was. Somebody had a radio somewhere because we used to get news every so often on what was going on. Luckily, I wasn't a prisoner for too long. It's a couple of months, just enough to wet my feet, so to speak.
Which camps were you in?
12A, and then just before the end, when the British, we were up in a sector where the British were, when they got close, they moved us to another camp. Luckily, we were able to get into a truck or something. We didn't have to walk that far. When we got into the other camp, we were there maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 days, whatever it was. And one night, the camp had sort of emptied out of the German guards. Came in Americans with MP. I don't know where they got them, but these were guys with MPs and clubs. And they said, nobody leaves here because if you guys get out, you're going to get in the way. And you're going to get killed. And the next morning, the British had come in. So we were kind of happy because outside there was one of the British, like the Red Cross. They had a big truck there that was full of hot noodles. And they would give out the noodles and they made sure that we didn't eat too much because our stomachs weren't that good. They shaved us. They cleaned us. Oh, but that, you know, I didn't tell you. The worst part of the prison camp was the lice. Oh, God, that was all over you constantly. Every morning when you got up, if you slept, you'd pick the lice and snap them and crap them and whatever it was, and they never left you, never left you. That was the really hard part. The Germans knew that it was going to be ending soon. They didn't bother us too much. It was just no food, but the lice, that I remember. That comes up, and that's rough.
Did you end up losing some weight in captivity?
Oh, definitely. I must have lost about 15 pounds. And then when you got to where you could eat and they were feeding, you had to be careful. You couldn't eat too much. We had guys that became pigs, and they ate so much within an hour or so. Within a couple of days, they died. I you know, in the prison camp, I remember going into a latrine and sitting there and watching, and all of a sudden there's a guy there talking to the wall, which, you know, wasn't unusual. So I looked up, and all of a sudden he raises his arms up and pulls a block out of the wall, one of the cement blocks, and he pulls something out, a bread, and he puts the block back. I said to him, what are you doing? He says, you got anything? You want something? I said, all right, what can you do for me? He said, what do you got? Well, at that point, I had 2 pair of pants on, you know, to stay warm, not, of course, at a prison camp, but before I got captured. I said, I got a pair of pants. He said, okay, give it to me, and you get out of here. I said, why? He says, I don't want you to watch. Okay. I knew what happened. Apparently, he had somebody on the other side of the wall, made a deal, and he gave me a loaf of bread, and I don't know what he got. And I took the loaf of bread, and I went to McEntee, and I said, look what we got. He said, how'd you do that? And I explained it to him. There was another deal that we had. The night before we left 12A, some guy had snuck into the group and got a hold of McEntee and myself. He said, do you have food? And we had saved some extra cans because we had gotten a Red Cross package and we couldn't take it with us. So we had saved some stuff, you know, like the powdered milk and things like that. He said, I have a camera. And I said, well, what do you want? He says, How much? You know, we went back and forth dealing in the different stuff that we had from, I think, 9 o'clock at night till about 2 o'clock in the morning. And we ended up with the camera, and McEntee, he got the camera. So eventually, you know, I did meet him in the States, and he gave me some pictures, but I have no idea what the heck ever happened to the pictures. You know, we were sort of taking care of ourselves in the prison camp. The hard part was the food, with very little food, until you got a Red Cross package, so you had to be careful and make it last. And the pestilence, the lice and stuff, that was it. Luckily, there was a little spigot, there was water, so that, you know, at least you had water, so you know, it wasn't that bad.
When you're a prisoner and you're not allowed to go out and work and you have all that time alone with your thoughts, did you ever think, I may not make it out of this? I may not make it back to the States again?
No. No. Nobody at 18 and a half or 19 feels that way. It's not going to happen. You're too busy thinking of what you were going to do that day. You know, how you're going to get by the day. And that was it. I never worried about being killed or anything like that. I was one of the lucky guys. I didn't have a wound on me.
Did you experience either witnessing or finding out that guys that you knew, guys that you served with, were not going to be able to come home?
Yes, there were a few guys. And I remember, well, one of the instances I remember, not in the camp, but on one of those freight cars where a guy just started screaming and yelling. He just lost it. And when we got out of the freight cars, they started taking bodies out, never realizing that guys had died in the cars. I had friends, but not that close, because I was a replacement. So I hadn't been with them that long. Other guys would either get wounded or they were sent somewhere else, so the other men came in. The only guy I was close with was McEntee. I remember him. He was head of the platoon, and we followed him. And this guy was so good, if he didn't get captured, I'm sure he would have become a lieutenant. They would have made him a lieutenant in the field. I'm almost sure of it.
So when you finally get liberated, and you said, you know, you were careful not to eat too much, how good did it feel to be a free man again after you had had to live in the absence of freedom?
It felt very, very good. The fact that I got cleaned, you know, they lined us up. They had these shears, you know, that you shear sheep. We, you know, we're all hairy guys. We got sheared and we got DDT was spread all over us. Now you can't use it, but they spread it all over us. We went into showers. We got clean. I felt good. I knew things that were going to be good.
What he didn't know was that his family still wasn't sure whether Harold was dead or alive. We'll hear about their reunion and how Harold was recently reunited with something he didn't even know was missing. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our fascinating conversation today with 96-year-old ex-prisoner of war, Harold Radish, a lifelong resident of the Big Apple, except for his time in the Army during World War II. Captured in February 1945 while serving with the 90th Infantry Division, he told us about some of his experiences in captivity as well as his liberation. And Harold, why don't you pick up where we left off? You'd lost about 15 pounds in captivity, but now you're a free man again. What did they do with you?
They flew us, the British flew us into Brussels. That was VE Day. There's a group of us, there must have been 10 of us, or maybe more, but I remember going, they let us go into a bar, we had some beers and was singing and all the rest of that, and then we went to some camp, and then they moved us from Brussels. Eventually we ended up, like all ex-POWs, at Camp Lucky Strike. And that was an adventure in itself. We were there for a week, and nothing was happening. Finally, I remember seeing Eisenhower flying in and getting out and making a big speech telling us, look, I'm trying to move you out, but we still have a war in Japan, but we'll get you out. So at that point, there were four of us in this little tent, and one guy, you know, some of these guys were sharp. They knew how to finagle and do things. Maybe I was more of a follower, but he said, let's go to Paris. We were outside of Le Havre. I said, can we get a pass? He says, what do you care about a pass? He says, we'll go. I said, but we'll be AWOL. He says, what are they going to do, put you back in a prison camp? So we went AWOL, and we were in Paris for about 3 or 4 days. The only thing is, we couldn't go to the Red Cross and get meals because we didn't have passes. What we could do is buy donuts or whatever it was. We got some change somehow. We got money. Guys had money, and we were able to get the donuts. One night, there was a curfew in Paris, and somehow we were out later than the curfew. And the MPs came through, and they saw us, and they put us in jeeps. And I ended up getting in a police station. I remember it was a high desk, and this guy was, I don't know what he was. I know he was an officer, but he was sitting on the top, and he says, you know, you missed the curfew, and I'm going to have to put you away for a little while. He says, you got any ID? I said, yes, I have a little piece of paper that says I'm reparations or something like that. And I handed it to him. Oh, he says, you're an ex-POW? Get the hell out of here. I don't want to see you, and I don't want to see you again anymore. Get out. And I was on my own, and I ended up finding the guys again. So, you know, I had my little adventures during the war, but luckily I was fortunate. Maybe I didn't think too much about what was going on. I just lived my soldiering day by day.
And to come back home to America.
Yes. That was great. They put us on a boat, a little one, I don't know what. You could eat yourself crazy. Anytime you wanted anything, you just went into the mess hall, and they gave you ice cream. They gave you steak. Whatever you wanted was fantastic. We docked in New York. I got to a phone booth, and I called home, and my mother answered the phone, and she said, my God, he's alive! And I said, I'll be home soon. That's when it hit me, how they suffered. We knew what was happening to us, but they didn't. My mother had gotten a missing in action telegram. I didn't know about that. And she had no idea what to do, but one of the aunts could read, write English. She spoke well, so she took my mother to the Red Cross, and they discussed something with the Red Cross. I saw my mother when I came home. Of course, there were a crowd of people outside the house, but when I saw my mother when I came home, at that point, that hit me. She was like a gray-haired little old lady. When I left, she was a vibrant, dark-haired, you know, a mother, took care of the kitchen, took care of the kids. But when I saw her, when I came back, that hit me took me a couple of months to get over that. They didn't know where we were, you know? They had no idea. So that's the suffering they went through. I think the people that were home, especially not knowing what was happening to their kids, were the ones that really took a real beating.
Yeah, it's a powerful perspective to consider. you know, that we don't think about enough. I'm just curious, too, since you got to come into your hometown, to New York Harbor.
Yes.
Was there some special significance to seeing the Statue of Liberty with what you'd been through?
Statue of Liberty, and then there was bands on the dock, and people were waving and all. And then there were three of us. We had to make a deal with a cab driver to take us somewhere. I don't know. And they had given us some money when we left the prison camp. You know, they owed us a salary, whatever it is, pay. So we had money, and we made a deal with the cab driver to take us. So I don't know. I think I may have paid more than any of the others, but that didn't matter. The thing was that I had, when I saw my mother, that's what hit me at that point. And then afterwards, they gave me a 60-day furlough. And I went from Brownsville, where I live, to the beach, Coney Island, Brighton Beach, almost every day. It was summertime, I remember. I just took it easy and swam, sat around, that kind of thing. I had a friend, some guy that lived nearby, so I would see him once in a while. Then I ended up going to Lake Placid, to a club up there that the government had taken over. And that was a place that they fed you. You got steak. There was waiters, waitresses. They had activities for you to do. At night, you could go out to the nightclubs in the area near Lake Placid. That was pretty good. I was supposed to stay there 2 weeks, but unfortunately, they made us leave within a week. After that, I went home, and I ended up at Fort Dix, and I stayed there for a while. I was a mailman. I would get up in the morning, go to the mail headquarters, get a sack, bring it back to headquarters or the little headquarters I was in, hand it to somebody, and that was my duty for the day. And I would get home. I stayed there maybe a month. I could get home from there two or three times, so it wasn't too bad. And finally, I got discharged from Fort Dix.
Well, and obviously, you met your wife, and you had your daughters, and you told us you became a shop teacher. And that piece of it, being a shop teacher, I'm just curious, because when you're a shop teacher, you teach all these young people how to make things with their hands and build things. And I've heard a lot of stories from prisoners of war over the years about some of the ingenuity that situation brought out in them, the creative ways they used materials that wouldn't usually contribute to something to build something. Did you have any stories like that, of stuff that you made in prison camp?
Not that I made, but I found, and it amazed me. There was coal, but the coal was, I'm trying to think of what the name would be for it, were little lumps. But it was hard, and that coal wouldn't burn. Somehow, the guys had figured out taking two cans and putting them together in a screen and making like a little fan and starting a little fire, and as you turn this fan, it put air against the coal, the piece of coal, and then you had a little fire so you could cook something. That amazed me. In fact, I have one in the ex-POW office, and since there's nobody around anymore, I don't go into the office anymore. They don't want us to come to the hospital, you know, until all this is over. I'm going to take that home. That's a bit of ingenuity that somebody had invented. I was lucky in becoming a shop teacher. That's a story in itself. When I went to junior high school, I went to a very rough junior high school. It was the kind of place where I brought lunch, a sandwich of some kind, and I found the biggest guy that I could, and I gave him the sandwich so that he would take care of me. I wouldn't get knocked around or anything. And when I got to the eighth grade, there was one more year. But some guy came up to me and he said, "Harold, you know, this place is not good for us. There's a school in Manhattan. It's called Hebrew Technical High School. and it's operated by some Jewish organization, and it's not a bad setup. They've got all kinds of shops. I said, all right, well, what do we have to do? He says, we got to take an exam. I said, okay. So we got some old exams that they had. We studied, and we got in. And I started there in the ninth grade. So that was the first year of high school. I loved it. It was woodworking, metalworking, electricity, forging, welding. Oh, it was up my alley. And I stayed there. It must have been the second year. And they ran out of money. This was a Jewish organization that was sponsored by some European group, and they were needed the money for refugees. So they sold the building. It was downtown 8th Street, somewhere in there, not too far from NYU. They sold the building and all of it to NYU for a dollar. And in those years, shops were very important in the schools. There aren't too many of them now. NYU was happy to get it, and the deal was anybody that had attended Hebrew Tech when they were ready for college could have a scholarship at NYU. They called it not shop, they called it industrial arts. I didn't care what they called it. I was going to go to college. I was very lucky. And from then on, I built a part of a house. I built a couple of extensions. I did a lot of the electricity. I did a lot of stuff that maybe I shouldn't do, but plastering, painting. I put in air conditioning in the 50s, you know, when we didn't have air conditioning. Sears Roebuck had a setup where you gave them plans, they gave you the stuff, and you bought it and all. I've always been working all my life, and I liked shop. Some of our kids were pretty rough. Eventually, I became a dean of discipline there, and that was an easy job. You worked with one or two kids, or if after school at 3 o'clock when there's a gang war, you went out there and you tried to break it up. And every so often, once I remember I was in the middle of something, and a kid came up to me, big guy, and he took me around, and he says, Radish, you get out of here. And he carried me across the street and got me out of the way. You know, I may not have been the best teacher, but I think I was liked.
I'm just curious, did you ever tell those students or even your daughters any of your stories from your days as a prisoner?
No. I would tell them about funny things that may have happened in the basic training camp or something. But no, I didn't want to pick on them and tell them what had happened. That wasn't important. I did, you know, mention, I did go through the examination with the VA to get some benefits and stuff. But I never told them anything. That I kept to myself. I didn't want to burden them with that.
And there's something I haven't asked you yet. Do you even know when you lost the cup from your mess kit?
No, I have no idea. I have no idea. I'll tell you what happened. When we used to get fed at night, they'd give us the mess. You know, you'd get a pan and you'd get the cup and you'd eat and you'd put it back. You didn't carry that stuff around while you were, you know, out in the soldiering and fighting and all. It made noise and all. So you didn't want that. So apparently I must have dropped it or something. My granddaughter a couple of months ago said, Grandpa, there's some guy who got in touch with me on Facebook. And he said something about a cup or whatever. Why don't you get in touch with him or let him get in touch with you? That was the first time I heard about that cup. And why I scratched my name on the bottom of a cup, I still don't know. Maybe I put my name in everything I owned, you know. I still remember R3290363. That was my number.
So the magic of the internet, a guy finds this cup, and somehow tracks down your granddaughter, and now that cup is in your possession all these years later.
Yes. He sent it to me. You know, he has an electronic stick, you know, like the guys on the beach. They go around looking for rings and stuff like that. You ever see them?
Sure. Yeah, the metal detectors.
The metal detector. And he must have one of those. And he is sort of an authority on the 90th Division because they were in that area. And he sent me a picture of a plaque on a stone of the 90th Division. And he must have a lot of these artifacts there and must have a lot of information also. You know, General Patton is buried in that area in Luxembourg.
Well, what did that mean to you to have something you didn't even remember that you'd lost, but now it's coming back to you with your name on it, representing long ago and far away?
You know, I can't fathom even drinking out of it. I don't remember. But there it is. There's a cup, and I was there. And he tells me the days I was there. And yes, it was January 1945, and somehow he knows the dates that my outfit was there.
Wow.
You know, when we got captured, the first prison camp we went to, they gave us postcards, and we filled out our names and the date and where we were, and they were supposed to have mailed them. I got that card about 2 months after I was home.
Wow.
As I keep thinking about it, that's why I felt so bad for my mother, you know. I shouldn't keep repeating it, but that was the hardest part of the whole business, yeah.
Well, I don't want to be melodramatic, but I'm just curious, you know, when you go through something like that, when there are reminders all around you of how different things could have worked out, and now you look back at all the years you've had since and your family and your career and the connections you've made, and now this latest chapter with a cup showing up out of the blue, how do you explain all that? What's your explanation for the way your life has worked out?
I'm just a lucky guy. That's my explanation. And it's been my thinking in the last few years. There is nothing you can do. Whatever you do, you can run, you can exercise, you can take drugs, you can get surgery, all the rest. If you don't have luck, or maybe it's the guy above, but if you don't have luck, it's not going to happen. If you're lucky, everything works out. You know, I'm so lucky. I'm the last guy in my group here in Queens and Brooklyn, Manhattan, you know, these XPOWs. It's just luck. I have no other way to figure it out. I've never been very religious, you know, so that I can't say that he's taking care of me, but he probably is. It's not deep thinking, but that's what I think it is.
Well, you're doing something right, and I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story that only you could tell us. I'm curious, one more thing. Is there something that you would say as you look back over all of this, that there's something you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I'll tell you, I am most proud of that I was able to serve and help my country. I am thankful for this was my generation, I think, was the term, you know, greatest generation. As I grew up, things got better and better and better. I was lucky enough to pass civil service exams so that I could work, make a living, a halfway decent living. I was lucky enough to find the right woman who brought up my, unfortunately, she got cancer, and about 7 years ago she passed away. But she was the right woman. I had two nice daughters, and she also was a civil servant and took care of the daughters and took care of the house. It was amazing, and now that I think of it, I worked. I didn't, but I would leave my house at 6:30 in the morning and do my teaching, etc., and then I had extra jobs. I didn't get home till about 10, but that wasn't the problem. She worked, and she took care of the kids and took care of the house. And she was the one that the meals made sure that everybody was healthy and happy and clean and things were taken care of. Those are things, you know, you're getting me to think about these things, and I think I'll sleep tonight, I'm sure. But I don't look back on, now I'm, you know, you ask me these things, so I'd look back on these things. And the more I look back on them, I may have had adventures, I've been part of the world, part of growing up, etc., but I've come out of it. great. You know, I'm still here. And I'm not sick. I still drive. And, you know, and I'm 96 years old. And I contact a 90-year-old woman every so often. So, you know, life is not bad.
It doesn't sound like it. And I can tell you don't take it for granted.
No, I don't take it for granted. I'm thankful. I'm thankful.
Well, aren't we thankful we got to spend this hour with Harold Radish. That's all the time we have, but thanks so much for listening. After hearing from an ex-prisoner of war, maybe you don't need me to say it again, but I will anyway, like I do each week. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.